Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the April 19th edition of the Journal. We'll start with the front page stories. Villa Grove Board of Education elects new member by Gabriella Agius. The Villa Grove School Board elected Charoli Burris as a new board member during the Villa Grove School Board meeting on April 17th. She was sworn in alongside Jim Clark and Jared Zimmerman. Jared Zimmerman will serve a 2-year term. Jim Clark, Tom Lillard, Kristen White, and Charoli Burris will serve 4-year terms. Vice President Bill Falk has stepped down from the board after 7 years. The board also elected the president, vice president, and secretary. Jim Clark was nominated as the president, Kristen White was nominated as the vice president, and Carissa Jones was nominated as the secretary. The board approved the meeting dates for the 2023-2024 school year. Meetings will continue to be held at 6 p.m. every third Monday of each month. The only exceptions are in January and February, when meetings will be held on Tuesdays due to holidays. The board also approved the first reading of the Press Plus issue number 111. For the superintendent's report, Dr. Carol Munson notified the board that Egyptian Trust will no longer allow employment in their health plan options. New bids for employee insurance will be open on Wednesday, April 19th. Superintendent Munson also reported on the status of the solar project. All agreements have been executed with Ideal Energy regarding installation and materials. Munson is currently working with Stan Fishbein of Clearview Capital on a lease and purchasing agreement. There is no hard date set for the beginning of construction, but 6 months is an estimate. For the window project, all of the supplies have been ordered and installation should begin in July, coinciding with other summer projects. For the principal's report, Principal Jones thanked the high school staff for a successful SAT-PSAT testing day. Jones congratulated the ACES team for their participation at state. Jones met with the Douglas County Health Department to discuss new resources and services available to students. The board will meet again on May 15th at 6 p.m. The next article is entitled Drug Endangered Children and Human Trafficking Training by Dominic Stallings. The Douglas County Recovery Oriented System of Care, ROSC, in partnership with the Douglas County Medical Reserve Corps, MRC, has organized a community-wide training event for the Douglas County community. Liesl Wingert, the Rural Health Project Coordinator, Eastern Illinois Region, for the SIU School of Medicine Center for Rural Health and Social Services Development, and Brad Ameter, the RCCU School Resource Officer and Deputy for the Richland County Sheriff's Department, will be providing a drug-endangered children and human trafficking training. Both trainers have received training through the National Allegiance for Drug-Endangered Children. The training will occur at the North Ward Elementary School Library on April 25th, 2023, from 5 to 7 p.m. We invite all community members to attend and encourage members of law enforcement, judicial staff, child welfare staff, medical personnel, behavioral health staff, teachers and school personnel, service providers, and faith-based agencies to attend the training. The Douglas County ROSC is eager to offer the training to Douglas County residents, and we hope to see many community members in attendance. This training aims to educate community members on how a child's caregiver's substance use addiction can impact a child's life. The training will also educate us on what familial human trafficking looks like, especially in rural communities. If you have any questions about the training, please contact the Douglas County ROSC Coordinator, Leanna Morgan, 217-549-7632. The third front page story is History of Tuscola's Presbyterian Church by Dominic Stallings. The First Presbyterian Church of Tuscola stood for 138 years before finally being demolished after a fire damaged the building beyond repair on July 9, 2022, according to a program describing the first 100 years of the church's history. The First Presbyterian Church was established on May 8, 1958. Before it was built, H.J. Venable would preach to families when he rode up and down the Okaw River Valley. He founded a small church at Fillmore, west of Arcola, on June 17, 1854. The church was called the Okaw Church for some time after. Some of the members of that church requested the Presbytery of Palestine to organize a new church in Tuscola. Two ministers from the presbytery came to a private residence owned by J.S. Walling in Tuscola to meet the 16 people who asked for a new church. At the time, there were very few houses in Tuscola, and most were built within the last 2 years. There weren't any trees or other landmarks to define the area besides ponds and dense prairie grasses. People who attended the meeting often had to make the journey on foot. Reverend George D. Millers was the first ordained minister for the church. New members joined from the Olcott Church and others from out of state as far away as Ohio and New York. Samuel Daggy, after whom a street was named in Tuscola, worked at the church for 15 years. Building the church at the time was no cheap endeavor. It cost $2,000 at the time. Today that amount would be the equivalent of $73,000, according to the U.S. inflation calculator. The church went through hard times in the following 10 years after its initial founding. Elders Noah Amen and Thomas Robinson led a group of 34 members out of the church to form the Second Presbyterian Church of Tuscola. However, the split did not last forever. In 1874, the two branches were reunited under the Presbytery of Mattoon. From 1876 to 1885, the number of active members dropped from 160 to 118. These numbers eventually bounced back and grew to over 200 by 1915. The original structure received two enlargements. First, in 1888, a manse was constructed to house the church minister and family. In June of 1902, the cornerstone for the present stone building was laid, and the new church was dedicated in November of the same year. A second manse was built on West Daggy Street in 1904 to replace the first. During the 1910s, there was also a plan to combine the First Christian Church, the Baptist Church, and the Presbyterian Church. It was voted down, possibly because worship was planned to be conducted at the Presbyterian Church. In the 1930s, the church suffered for at least 10 years. Reverend Kelly served the congregation without salary during that time. For the church's 90th anniversary, a redecoration program costing $10,000 was completed in the church. The old pipe organ was replaced by a Hammond organ given by the Van Voorhis family. The church also received new carpeting. The Hine Room was dedicated to the many faithful years of service by Dr. C. L. Hine to the Tuscola Boy Scout organization. Hine was also a Sunday school superintendent. The church went through another remodeling in 1953. The sanctuary was remodeled and redecorated. The Hine Room was redecorated with knotty pine paneling. The kitchen was remodeled with additional cupboard space and four stainless steel sinks. The remodeling was achieved through the support of the members of the time. The church adopted a new theme of Prairie Perseverance for the 90th anniversary of its founding, celebrating the church's survival even with relatively small numbers of people supporting the church. However, the church did close its door finally after 94 years in 1996. The congregation reluctantly voted to disband after Dr. William Bottomer was announced he was giving up his ministerial position in the church. Bottomer, a professor of religion at Millikan University in Decatur, acted as pastor in both the Tuscola and Newman parishes at the time. The church didn't stand abandoned without purpose for long. According to an article by Colleen Lehman, Diana and Gary Henning bought the building for $60,000 at an auction on August 12, 1999. Diana had always admired the stone building, which closely resembled a European castle. The location was suitable for her two businesses, Diana's and Tomorrow's Treasure. I always thought it looked as much like an old castle as it did a church, and we felt that anyone who had seen the building would remember it that way too, said Diana on renaming the building the Castle Mall. In the article, Diana states, "We felt if everyone else was going to work on the downtown, we should get something going in our building, particularly since it had quite a history in starting out as the Cashford Art Store." The Castle Mall sold a variety of items, including Diane's dolls, children's clothes for wedding, and formal wear. Diana also created custom wedding items such as veils, garters, and flower arrangements. The rest of the auditorium was filled with other curiosities and collectibles and served as a sort of gift shop as well as supply store for crafts. Diane and Gary Herring eventually sold the building to Daniel and Sarah Escalera in 2018 for $50,000, according to the Douglas County Assessor's website. The Castle Mall burned down July 9, 2022 in a suspected arson case. The structure was demolished in April after the city took possession of the building. The city sued the previous owners in order to ensure the removal of the broken-down structure after finding it to be unsafe. Douglas County Museum will be opening a time capsule on May 8th, City Council meeting. The capsule was found in the cornerstone of the church. And the final front page story, VG Council discusses Richmond Sport Complex improvements. Mayor Cassandra Eversole Gunter introduced Jake Wolf from Engineering Resource Associates at the Philagrove City Council meeting on April 10th. Wolf presented several options for upgrades to the Richmond Sports Complex. He noted that his company had worked with the forest preserves and park districts all over the state. He showed mock-ups of three potential changes, which the county discussed at length. The council approved the consent agenda, which included minutes of the closed session of the city council held on February 27th, the minutes of the regular meeting held on March 13th, and the minutes of the February 27th committee of the whole meeting. The consent agenda also included financial reports for February and payment of bills in the amount of $398,000. Also included was a payment number 9 to Brewer and Russo in the amount of $235,000. The consent agenda also included approval to change order number 12 for the community center regarding changing the floor of the gymnasium, and also approved the administrator's attendance to WIU's Midwest CDI. Chief Robert Ree reported that he had completed his budget request for 2023-24. Bethany Soroka, director of the Community Center Programs and Services, reported that baseball, softball, and soccer programs were getting underway. She also noted that Carl had donated an AED to the city. She also noted that sponsors for the Community Center were coming forward on schedule. Public Works Director Mark McSell then finished the spring reported that spring cleanup was finishing up. He also noted the new Public Works building project were nearing completion and the ball fields were all ready for gameplay. Administrator Athey reported that she had been working on bond closing along with writing the ordinances which are to be discussed. She also had been in discussions with a developer who was looking to build a new complex in Villa Grove. Mayor Ebersol Gunter then made a short statement letting the council know that Garrett Miller, a representative of the rodeo who is considering locating in Villa Grove, would be at the next council meeting to discuss the proposal. Next, Gunther called for a vote on ordinances assigning street names and changes to real estate on East Front Street and Harrison Streets. The council then voted unanimously to approve Ordinance 2023 MC07, which permanently names the street that runs through Henson Park as Frank Thomas Drive. Ordinance 2023 MC08, which establishes an employee appreciation policy, and Resolution 2023 R03, which designates Beach Lane with an honorary street name, Gabbard Lane, in honor of Bill and Joyce Gabbard and their myriad contributions to the city of Villa Grove. The council unanimously approved 2023 R04, which declares surplus equipment for trade, and Resolution 2023 R05, which waived the formal bidding requirement and accepted a quote for building insulation and finishing. The council then unanimously approved the quote for installing a sump pump in the Zest for Life Center and approval of the survey boundary for the Renfro property contingent upon formal plat map approval of Crawford's second subdivision. We'll move now to the obituaries. Richard Lee Ike, 79, of Tuscola, formerly of Lima, Ohio, passed away on April 16, 2023 in Charleston. Private graveside services and burial will be held at Shawnee Cemetery in Lima, Ohio. Hilligosh Schrader Funeral Home handled the local arrangements. Marjorie Janet Gagné passed away peacefully on April 13, 2023, at the age of 82. Her children Stephanie and Stephen were by her side as her beautiful soul left the world. Her unmatched beauty, grace, and inner spirit leave a legacy that will never be forgotten. Raymond William Morris, 101, of Neoga, formerly of Charleston, passed away at 9:59 p.m. on Saturday, April 8, 2023, at Heartland Senior Living in Neoga. Funeral services were held Thursday, April 13th at the Emmanuel Lutheran Church, Charleston. Pastor Kenneth Hoover officiated. Burial was at Rest Haven Memorial Gardens in Mattoon. Visitation was held on Wednesday, April 12th at the church. The Edwards Funeral Home assisted with arrangements. Ruth Harris, 91, of Tuscola, passed away at 3:15 p.m. Sunday, April 9, 2023, at the Tuscola Healthcare Center in Tuscola. Funeral services were held Thursday, April 13th at the Hilligosh Schrader Funeral Home, Tuscola, with Reverend Les Evans officiating. Burial followed at the Tuscola Township Cemetery. Visitation was held prior to the service on Thursday at the funeral home. Dean Eugene Edwards, 84, of Arcola, passed away at 8:36 a.m. on Sunday, April 9, 2023, at his son's residence in Cerro Gordo. Funeral services were held Saturday, April 15th at the Edwards Funeral Home. Alfred Edwards, Jr. officiated. Burial was in the Arcola Cemetery. Visitation was held prior to the funeral at the funeral home. Barbara Ray Schrock, 85, of Paxton, formerly of Champaign, died at 5:50 p.m. Tuesday, April 11, 2023, at the Accolade Paxton Senior Living Facility. Funeral services were held Saturday, April 15th at the Stratford Park Bible Chapel, Champaign. Visitation was held prior to the service. A graveside service was held Saturday, April 15th at the Grandview Memorial Gardens in Champaign. Schrader Funeral Home Arcola assisted the family with arrangements. 32nd Arthur Amish Country Quilt Show, April 27th to 29th at the Auto Center. A variety of quilts will be displayed at the 32nd Annual Arthur Amish Country Quilt Show, Thursday through Saturday, April 27th to 29th at the Auto Center, 2056 County Road, 1800 East, just 1/2 mile south of Arthur. The show will be open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Thursday and Friday, and 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday. Admission is $5. In addition to the quilts in the exhibit, close to another 100 pieces will be sold during the annual auction on Saturday, April 29th, starting at noon. Entries will be judged in each of the five categories: baby, wall hanging, antique, pieced, pieced machine quilted, and pieced hand quilted, and mixed techniques. Ribbons and gift certificates will be awarded for the first, second, and third place in each category, along with the best in show winner receiving a $100 gift certificate, and all are redeemable for merchandise at participating Arthur merchants. Visitors to the show will determine the winner of the People's Choice Award ribbon. Those in attendance will also have the opportunity to enter a raffle drawing to win a queen-size double wedding ring quilt. The drawing will take place on Saturday afternoon. In addition to the quilts on display, there will be a market vendor area with a lunch stand with cheeseburgers and barbecue sandwiches, wraps, taco salad, cinnamon rolls, desserts, and drinks available by the kitchen of Doris Yoder. The Arthur Quilt Show has become the largest spring quilt exhibition in Illinois Amish country. It attracts entries from all over Illinois, including many Amish-crafted quilts. For more information on this year's show, you can call 217-543-2287. Illinois Deer Donation Program donates 33,000 meals to area families. With community support, the Illinois Deer Donation Program had a successful first season. During the 2022 season, 8,400 pounds of donated venison were processed by local meat processors. The meat was donated to 37 food pantries, resulting in 36,000 meals to area families. In response to rising food and meat prices and the challenge of food pantries have in obtaining meat, University of Illinois Extension, along with key partners, launched the Illinois Deer Donation Program in 2022. The Illinois Deer Donation Program provides a pathway to expand community access to lean protein throughout East Central Illinois and reduces barriers to healthier lifestyles. During the 2022 deer hunting season, hunters were able to drop off their harvested deer at one of six area meat processors to be donated. The cost of meat processing was covered by the processors and donations to the program. Once processed, the venison was distributed to area food pantries to help families in need. Once donated to food pantries, Illinois Extension SNAP education staff provided nutrition education about venison and offered recipe samples. This gave pantry guests the opportunity to get ideas of how to cook with venison if they weren't familiar. The SNAP Ed educator, Meredith Probst, expressed her appreciation for area support. "We're grateful to our partners that made this program possible. They rallied around a goal of increasing food security in their communities," Probst said. The program is funded in part by the Health Equity Achieve Together Project, a multidisciplinary collaboration with the University of Illinois Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program Education. Take Time for Family Night this April by Debbie McClellan. April is here and brings many changes: the temperature, the clock, even our clothing. Why not add one more change to the list? Get out your calendars and pick a night for family night in to relax and spend time together. What children really want is more time with friends and family. What gets in the way? Children tell us that their family schedules are controlled by sports, school activities, homework, and their parents' work. A family night in doesn't have to be a major event. In fact, simple things are often the most fun and relaxing. Here are some ideas to get you thinking about your April family night in. Become bird watchers. Check out books, websites, or apps on birds. Try to identify birds by their appearance or their bird calls. Get out the binoculars and see how many different birds you can find. Build a birdhouse, bird feeder, or bird bath. You can make easy bird treats by cutting a fun shape out of cardboard, spread with peanut butter, and sprinkle on bird seed. Punch a hole in the top, attach a colorful string, and hang it in a tree. Bingo nature hike. Work together to make up bingo cards out of heavy paper or cardboard with an equal number of boxes across and down. In the boxes, write specific items to find outside, like a pebble, a daffodil, leaf, or feather. Give each family member a card and search for the items on their card. See who can get bingo first. Celebrate Earth Day by planting a family tree. Check out which trees grow well in your climate. Are you going to plant it in a sunny or shady spot? Choose a tree. Let everyone help at planting time, digging, preparing the hole, planting, and watering. Also learn to take care of your family tree. Each year you can have a birthday picture of your family and the family tree. Have a joke night. See how many jokes everyone can tell. Design and make paper airplanes. Test them out. See which plane can fly the highest, the farthest, the fastest, land the softest, etc. Have a bubblegum blowing contest. Can everyone make a bubble at the same time? Who can blow the biggest bubble? There are a few rules for your family night in. Just make certain that everyone in the family gets a chance to actively participate. You don't need lots of preparation or planning. You may not remember the TV show you watched last week, but doing fun things together will build memories that last a lifetime. Bill calls for review of teacher licensing standards by Peter Hancock, Capital News, Illinois, out of Springfield. Some Illinois lawmakers are calling for a review of one of the tests prospective teachers must pass in order to be licensed in Illinois. The test is known as the Teacher Performance Assessment, or EDTPA, and is intended to determine whether a prospective teacher has the knowledge and skills necessary to be effective in the classroom. It has been a requirement for teacher licensing in Illinois since 2015. State Senator Tom Bennett, Republican of Gibson City, said he started hearing concerns about the test from people in his district, and he later learned that those concerns were shared by other lawmakers. And it was over and over again, he said in an interview. I was only hearing from a few folks and thought it was the best thing since sliced bread, which okay, but then I hear things from the other side, and it's like I'm not hearing the same thing from people in my district. Every state has its own criteria for licensing teachers, and every school of education uses its own curriculum for training teachers. Developed at Stanford University, the EDTPA was intended to be a standardized way of measuring an aspiring teacher's knowledge and abilities, regardless of what state they came from or which college or university they attended. The assessment is given at the end of a prospective teacher's student teaching experience. It's a performance-based assessment that, among other things, requires applicants to submit a portfolio that includes actual lesson plans and tests that they've administered, examples of their students' work, and other materials that demonstrates their knowledge and competence. The portfolios are then scored by teachers and teacher educators with expertise in the subject and grade level in which the applicant is seeking a license. Bennett said that having outside evaluators who have never met or worked with the applicants scoring their portfolios is one of the issues that concerns him about the EDTPA. They're weighing in and their weight is pretty heavy, he said. If they pass, great. If they don't, it's based on this evaluation from these folks that don't understand the whole situation. So that just got my attention. Senator Meg Longran, Capel, Democrat of Shorewood, a co-sponsor of the bill, said she has concerns that EDTPA is so rigorous and intensive that it could deter some people from ever trying to become a teacher. You'll have someone that wants to be a math teacher, and when they get to the point where they have to do all this work for their student teaching and this additional rigorous testing and project, she said, and what you end up with is having, they're like, why should I go through all of this and maybe not even make it only to make $40,000 coming out of college when I could stop what I'm doing right now as a junior, take a couple of extra classes and become an accountant and come out making $60,000 to $65,000. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Governor Pritzker issued an executive order suspending the use of the EDTPA, but that extended executive order will expire when the disaster declaration is lifted on May 11th. Bennett is the lead sponsor of Senate Bill 1488, which passed unanimously out of the Senate on March 30th and now awaits action in the House. It would continue the suspension of the EDTPA through August 31st, 2025. It would also establish a task force to evaluate teacher performance assessment systems and make recommendations to the State Board of Education and the General Assembly by August 1st, 2024. I think it's a good time to sit back. Let's review it. See what we've got, and I'm grateful for the bipartisan support from a number of Republicans and Democratic senators really feeling the same way, Bennett said. April is National Financial Capability Month. Three tips to protect your money in an emergency. April is the National Financial Capability Month, a reminder that everyone should arm themselves with the knowledge and skills to effectively manage their finances every day, but especially in case of an emergency. FEMA is offering three key steps to financially prepare for unexpected disasters. 1. Gather financial and critical personal, household, and medical information. Have extra copies, originals or copies of passports, driver's licenses, insurance, and medical information, birth and marriage certificates, and other critical documents stored in a safe, easily acceptable location, such as a safe deposit box, external hard drive, or on the cloud to avoid any issues. 2. Consider saving money in an emergency savings account that can be used in any crisis. Keep a small amount of cash at home in a safe place, too. It is important to have small bills on hand because ATMs and credit cards may not work during a disaster when you need to purchase necessary supplies of fuel or food. 3. Obtain property, health, and life insurance if you do not already have them. Not all insurance policies are the same. Review your policy to make sure the amount and type of coverage meet the requirements for all possible hazards. For example, homeowners insurance does not typically cover flooding, so you may have to purchase flood insurance from the National Flood Insurance Program. An easy way to start preparing your finances for an emergency is by completing the Emergency Financial First Aid Kit. This important document offers guidance on organizing and securing important documents, provides important advice on managing finances, and describes what to expect should a disaster strike your community. For even more information on how to financially prepare for an unexpected emergency or disaster, visit www.ready.gov/financial/preparedness. How to prepare soil for spring planting. Spring is a season of rejuvenation, and perhaps nowhere is that rebirth more noticeable than in the yard. Each spring, grass begins to grow again as inviting landscapes beckon people outdoors. Extra sunlight and rising temperatures make spring a great time to plant flowers, grasses, and trees. To ensure successful planting, homeowners must take steps to prepare the soil. Healthy soil can provide the ideal conditions for roots to take hold, helping plants establish themselves before potentially harsh summer conditions arrive. Preparing soil may seem like an extensive job, but a simple approach may be all that's necessary to create conditions that promote plant growth this spring. Clean up the previous month's mess. Whether homeowners live in a region marked by year-round warmth or places where winter typically features heavy snowfall, it's a good idea to clean out the area prior to spring planting. Fallen leaves, rocks, grass clippings, and other debris can contribute to compacted soil that makes it hard for plants to establish healthy roots. Clear away any debris prior to planting or taking the next step in your soil preparation routine. Loosen the soil. Once debris has been cleared away, loosen the soil. Depending on the size of the area you'll be planting, you may need to invest in tools like a shovel, spade, spading fork, and/or lawn edger. If you're planting in a small area, such as a deck planter box that still has soil from last year's planting inside it, you can either clean the box and replace the soil entirely or dig around with a handheld trowel, cultivator, and/or weeder. It's important to loose all of the soil around where you'll be ultimately plant prior to planting to ensure water can reach the roots and help them establish themselves once planting is completed. Test and, if necessary, amend the soil. A simple pH test can help determine the acidity or alkalinity of the soil. This is an important step, as soil that is too acidic or alkaline can decrease the availability of nutrients the plants will need to thrive. In addition to conducting a pH test, which can be purchased at little cost at a local home improvement store, homeowners can contact their local cooperative extension service to test their soil quality. These tests will reveal soil pH, but also can shed light on the texture of the soil and other components. Once the test is conducted, the local co-op extension service may recommend amendments to improve the nutritional quality of the soil so new plants can thrive. Soil conditions go a long way toward determining if new plants will thrive. Preparing the soil prior to spring planting can ensure a successful season. And that is about all that we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerke saying goodbye and see you next week.